A phrase pops into the head of Edward T. Toppington IV from out of nowhere. Everybody, all of them, it's back to blood. Religion is dying, but everybody still has to believe in something. So, my people, that leaves only our blood. La raza, as the Puerto Ricans cry out. The race, cries the whole world. All people everywhere have but one last thing on their minds. Back to blood. In all of American letters, only one writer could have produced that passage, which comes from his latest novel. With us today, Tom Wolfe. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. A native of Richmond, Virginia, Tom Wolfe received his undergraduate degree from Washington and Lee University and a doctorate in American Studies from Yale. Mr. Wolfe is the author of classic essays, including Radical Chic, and more than a dozen books, including the nonfiction works The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and The Right Stuff, and the novels The Bonfire of the Vanities, A Man in Full, and I and Charlotte Simmons. Mr. Wolfe's latest book, a novel set in Miami, Back to Blood. Tom, this is the point at which I ordinarily say to guests, thank you for joining us. But since we're in your apartment, thank you for inviting us in.
It was nothing.
Back to blood. Religion is dying. Back to the ethnic group or tribe as a source of meaning. This is a sort of the sort of question that the college freshman wishes he could ask the great author. And here I am with the great author. Does the theme interest you first, this notion of back to blood? Or did you say to yourself, Miami, there's a bustling, boisterous town, and then begin to sort out the theme from the location?
Now, this idea of back to blood hit me, must have been at least 5-6 years ago, maybe further back than that. And you can see right now there are so many people who essentially have become atheists. Mm-hmm. Less in the U.S. than in Europe, incidentally. Nietzsche predicted all of this. He said, when he had his famous, probably the most famous statement ever in modern philosophy, God is dead, mm-hmm. which was not an atheist manifesto. Although he was an atheist, it was a warning. He said that educated, well-to-do people, he's talking about Europe, that no longer believe in God. And the result is not going to be what you think. So the result is going to be demoralization in which Europeans will sort of stumble osteoporotically through the 20th century, and then a century of, he's writing in 1885 now, a century of wars such as never been fought before. The rise of bloodthirsty brotherhoods, since they don't believe in God, they just believe in taking whatever they can. Right. He did everything but use the terms Nazi, fascist, and communist. And he made this prediction. He said it'll start happening in one generation. If you see a generation is 30 years, he was talking about 1915, and the war, the First World War, started
right on time.
I mean, it's incredible. But now what interests me is if he was that right, the world wars, nobody ever thought of such a thing, these bloodthirsty brotherhoods, nobody had ever thought of that. Then he said, but in the 21st century, he mentioned the 21st century, he said, will come something worse than the world wars. He said, it will be the total eclipse of all values. He said, that's going to pain you a lot more than warfare. He blamed a lot of this on Darwin. It wasn't blame, it was just saying Darwin. In fact, he said Darwin is correct. He said, but it's too bad he is. And I think with sort of that in mind, I first said, well, People are not going to simply go off in some chaotic way. They're going to look for something to moor themselves to. And I began to see it more and more this is not a technical survey, but of people believing in their bloodline. It's very easy to do. It's kind of nice. Except that you constantly have to contradict yourself.
Let me try. I'm going to talk fast for about 60 seconds to try to convey some flavor of Back to Blood, this book. Nestor Camacho is the central character, young Cuban police officer. Nestor engages in heroic exploits. He saves a Cuban refugee from falling to his death. He subdues a drug dealer who's trying to choke a fellow cop. Every exploit is so misunderstood and so twisted that instead of being viewed as a hero, he's seen as a racist, as a traitor to the Cuban people, and the chief of police yanks him off active duty. Magdalena, his girlfriend, breaks up with Nestor, first to take up with Norman Lewis, a psychiatrist who's a sex addiction expert, and then to take up with Sergei Korolyov, a Russian criminal. Set pieces in the book include a yacht regatta that turns into a floating orgy, an art sale to frenzied billionaires, and a criminal investigation in a retirement home filled with aggressive old ladies on walkers. Back to Blood also includes $70 million in forged paintings and a brutal murder. John O'Sullivan, reviewing Back to Blood in National Review, quote, Tom Wolfe long ago declared a preference for great, teeming, socially panoramic novels. This preference is probably shared by most readers, and that ensures that it will be viewed with distaste by most critics. Close quote. Why the big canvas?
You mean
Yes. All your novels, Bonfire, A Man in Full, Charlotte Simmons, these are Bruegel-like in their sense of activity.
I devoutly believe that each of us is determined by two things, not just your own psychological makeup and your own hormonal makeup and the rest of it, but by the fact that you're going to intersect with society. I think of the individual as vertical and the society as this broad plane, and you're going to change when you intersect with society, whether you want to or not. And I just think there is no way to understand individuals, particularly today, without understanding the society around them. A lot of people just don't agree. without a lot of novels, love, they were influenced by the French, which is you have the psychological novel is the best in terms of the French.
The precious, the interior, one person seated in a room, right? So, I'm thinking as you talk, I'm thinking of Trollope's great novel, The Way We Live Now, and the emphasis there, in your view, would be on we. If you want an accurate picture, it has to be a big one. Only the wide-angle lens captures the truth.
Well, in my opinion, the great period of the American novel was about 1893, when Maggie, A Girl of the Streets, was written, to 1939 with Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. In that period, it really ends in 1939, in that period you have Faulkner, this Sinclair Lewis, Dreiser, with that great novel, Sister Carrie.
Sister Carrie.
You have my namesake, Thomas Wolfe, you have Zora Neale Hurston, and they are all realists. And some of them hate the United States, and some of them are maybe sympathetic, but they all want to get down on paper every last detail of this extraordinary country. Well, they may want to then flail the country with what they found. And that stops all of a sudden after the Second World War. And I think it's because of the French influence. You know, we've always felt so inferior, actually, in terms of taste, to the French. and more so than to the English. And oh my God, we're so intimidated by people like Foucault and Derrida. And you mentioned this in France, and people say, "Who?" And I say, "Foucault, Derrida." "Oh yeah, I remember them. What was it? 1953, was it?" I'll admit I myself think that everybody has a better accent than we do, particularly the British and the French.
Tom, back to me as a freshman, college freshman, with questions to ask the author. Back to Blood strikes me as actually a very complicated read. So you guide me through my reactions. The prose is so exuberant. There's just such as that page by page and sentence by sentence, it seems as though Tom Wolfe is conveying this wild sense of fun. And yet, as you keep reading and things begin to go wrong, and you even notice the author's asides, you begin to get a terrible sense of decline. Just a couple of examples. Dress. We're at a restaurant called Chez Toi. Quote, "The maitre d' was instantly recognizable. He was the one dressed like a gentleman." That's the way it seems to go these days. Art. We're at the art sale. A rich man's artistic advisor, or AA. Here's what she says to her billionaire patron. "No cutting-edge artist touches materials anymore, or instruments." "What do you mean, instruments, AA?" said the billionaire who employs her. "Oh, you know," she said, "paintbrushes, clay, shaping knives, chisels. All that's from the manual age. Remember painting? That seems so 1950s now." So, Back to Blood is a portrait of decadence in the strict sense of the term, a culture decaying.
I wouldn't put it that...
You wouldn't.
I wouldn't put it that strong.
Don't let me become too gloomy about it.
My reaction when I... Particularly, you were just referring to what I call no hands art. And I tend to say, "Look at that one! Look at that one!" Like Jeff Koons, who builds these 45-foot rabbits out of dirt. Of course, he doesn't build them. His elves build them. He had pictures taken of himself and an Italian prostitute who he may even have married. She made news in Italy because of an affair with God knows who. He had the two of them photographed by a good photographer in every possible way that you can insert part of one body into another. I mean, there were things I had, God, never heard of. And then these were sent, he didn't touch the film even. The film was sent to Switzerland, where there were elves who make things out of glass. They were turned into three-dimensional pieces. And each one sells for more than $1 million. That's no hands art.
And that, as it appears in Back to Blood, is a joke. It's what are we to make of it?
Well, actually, I wrote a short book about all this called The Painted Word, and I tried to trace the social origins of admiring what would ordinarily seem grotesque or totally untalented. And it started again in France in the 1880s. And there was great positive connotation to admiring art that was not understandable. For example, Mallarmé, Baudelaire, Rimbaud, they are not easy reads.
Right.
And at the time, the French said, and Zola and Maupassant were the most popular writers in the world at that time, both realists. And the French intellectuals began to say, we don't care about this plodding realism. We like essences. And that's what Rimbaud and Mallarmé give us. Well, once you have to decide that, your cry is, I understand things that the mob, the rabble, and the middle class, so to speak, doesn't comprehend. I'm immeasurably superior to them. And it's carried right on into our time. When I wrote the painted word, I thought spelled this all out very carefully.
It spelled it out so carefully that the critics howled. That one caused reverberations throughout this town.
As a matter of fact, the Art Forum, which is the most, takes itself more seriously than any other art magazine in the country, or perhaps the world, said that this man Wolf is a hopeless son of a bitch. Now, they didn't want anybody to think that because they were giving attention to me that there might be something to it. You know, if somebody eats up inch after inch of type, so there must be something going on. They want to make sure you knew there's nothing worth looking at again. Son of a bitch. I've never seen that word used in an art magazine before, in all sincerity.
Tom, back to Blood. Magdalena, who is the regatta that turns into an orgy. We have Norman Lewis, the psychiatrist, the immensely learned man, the sex addict, a sex addiction therapist, who says to her, I'm paraphrasing now, which I know is a risky thing to do with you, but you're going to see, if we stay here all night, you're going to see people behave as they behave in conditions of complete freedom, no rules. They'll behave like bonobos. You'll see animal-like behavior. And to him, this is thrilling. And Magdalena replies, your note, Magdalena felt more than depressed. Something about it made her afraid. All right. That's in the book. Now, John O'Sullivan's comment, and then I'll ask you to comment on all of this. John O'Sullivan's comment, Wolfe's vision of present-day America is eerily similar to the Rome of antiquity before Constantine. Where that antiquity was pre-Christian, the new antiquity is post-Christian. Its original brand of Protestant Christianity no longer influences it. The WASP elites no longer even pretend to believe. It is a world of fear, superstition, and constant insecurity. So this boisterous, exhilarating book is a portrait of the apocalypse?
Not in my mind, but I'll go along with him on the in this business of constant uncertainty. And I think it's very striking. If you think of the mating habits of in this country, of people in general, today, it is expected at every level of society, bottom to top, that a boy and a girl dating, to use an outmoded term, are going to be having right at it right away, if not after, not immediately the second date. That's as far as they can go without breaking up. And so they now go everywhere in the world together. They're not married, and some of them are quite young. And it's just a given that they're going to be kicking the gong around. Now, that's a complete change from the way things were immediately after the Second World War. I mean, it's a complete change from what was true, let's say, 50 years ago. Everything was done to mask living together. Dickens was mad about an actress called Ellen Ternan.
Yes, yes.
And he persuaded her mother to come along on their trips as a chaperone. Now, see, that was okay if you had the chaperone. Well, the mother was so giddy with excitement that the great Charles Dickens wanted her daughter. But today, Anna Karenina, the whole plot of that wonderful book would be like a page six item today.
Yes.
Or
that Noel Coward Brief Encounter. You couldn't have the play if adultery were as common, right? The whole drama, he couldn't have written it.
Yeah.
So the constant insecurity comes in.
Well, I think that's the past 50 years have been very hard on women, I think. Mm. When I wrote I Am Charlotte Simmons about college life, the rule then was four dates. If the girl had not, as they used to say, come across in four dates, the guy gave up. And then the next thing I knew, it was, oh, not very long after that, it was two dates. And then the last time I looked into it, a couple of kids said to me, "What do you mean dates?" Mm. So it was more bonobo style.
Right.
That's one reason the bonobos and the chimpanzees haven't gotten very far. The girls are always sticking their bottoms up in the air in the middle of the day. It's distracting.
Nestor Camacho, again, he's the central character. As best I can, as I reckon it, he's the one character who behaves honorably throughout. Edward T. Topping IV is a coward. The newspaper editor is a coward. Religion is dying, says Edward T. Topping to himself. And yet Nestor, I have a quotation here, Nestor thinks to himself, "I always believed that there is a righteous God." And you entitled the final chapter of the book, which is about Nestor, "The Knight of Hialeah." So here's a scene. Magdalena, his former girlfriend, she dropped him to take up with a sex addiction. I don't even know quite how to utter those syllables. Sex addiction expert, Norman Lewis. She leaves him to take up with Sergei Korolev, who turns out to be a lavish bad guy. And he throws her over, and then she goes back to Nestor in tears and asks for help. And Tom Wolfe writes of Nestor's response, "As has been true throughout recorded history, rare is the strong man strong enough to shrug off a woman's tears. To that, add Nestor's pride in his strength and, dare he even think it, valor as protector. The tears of a woman pleading for the protector, he caved." He did help her. But what are we to make then of Nestor Camacho? In this world in which values are dissolving, the character whom you place at the center and toward whom, to the extent that you as the author tip your hand and demonstrate your sympathies, is a man of strength, bravery, chivalry, old-fashioned term, faith. And so back to blood may contain an orgy at sea, but it's still the work of a Virginia gentleman.
Well, I used to climb ropes the way he does. That's the greatest that's the greatest bodybuilding exercise there is.
Climbing ropes hand over hand.
Without using your legs.
Without using your legs.
I just passed that along as a tip for anybody who might be watching. Now, it's purposely a picture of what I would consider a sterling character. And look at the reward he gets for his honesty and his bravery. Because the man he brings down from who is stranded and freaking out on top of a mast, the man happens to be a Cuban refugee, and he, Nestor, is a policeman sent up there to get the guy down, mainly so that people will get off the nearby bridge and move
the
traffic on Friday afternoon.
Right, right.
He is considered a traitor for bringing this. And even if he says, "What is that I supposed to do? They ordered me to go up there and do this." Aha, they ordered you. That makes it all right. Huh? They bring it back to Nazi period. And so he's frustrated over and over again in this way, but he's true to his...
So this is Charlie Croker in A Man in Full and Nestor Camacho. Here we have a man who loves modernity and modernism in some ways. You based much of your prose style on the Russian author, begins with Zamyatin. Is that not right?
Yeah.
Yevgeny Zamyatin, early 20th century Russian author. So you're a modernist in all kinds of ways, but your heroes are manly men of faith and bravery whom the world spurns and abuses, and yet they continue on. And so Tom Wolfe is saying, Nietzsche may have been right. Values are dissolving, but stick with them. Is that right?
Well, it's not. I didn't see it as a message. I did see it as somebody who refuses to buckle under to what everybody else is doing. And the same was true of my character, Conrad Hensley, in A Man in Full.
Man in Full, right.
And, you know, I never really thought of it as a purposeful device, but he does, in that is Nestor, in many ways does show the failings of other people, because they wouldn't do the kind of things that that he does. But more than anything else, it's, I just love all these people. I mean, like in Bonfire of the Vanities, these investment bankers and the people going wild on markets, and they're just, they catch my eye, and I'm transfixed. This is a rather wild period, in no small part because a lot of conventional values have been dropped.
All right. How does Tom Wolfe do it? One summer evening, this would be a couple of years ago, out on Long Island, when you were working on Back to Blood, you and I had dinner. And I did something I recognized almost before the words were out of my mouth. It was a terrible mistake. The wrong question to ask a working writer, but I asked. And I said, how did the day's writing go? And your face fell. And you said it was a struggle, that writing had never gotten easier for you, and that the only thing that was different now was that these days you could lift your gaze from your desk across to the bookshelf and see dozens of books with your name on the binder and say to yourself, Wolf, you've done it before. You must be able to do it again. Now, you must have been having me on.
No, it is the hardest work that I can think of, even though it's supposedly coming off the top of your head, because I think it has to be journalistically based. No other writer would say that. It has to be sound reporting. But just simply putting the words together is very tough business. And I find that the only thing that really works is a quota system. If you just make yourself pound out, you can tell I used a typewriter.
Do you still use a typewriter?
It's terrible. Today, I'm back to handwriting. The typewriters lose so many parts that you can't get again. You have to take the ribbons in to be re-inked. You have to go on eBay to get the thing that returns the
antique stores to replace the springs. But you were never tempted by the word processor?
No, I tried. I tried again. I was born too early. That's one thing. That's the real answer. But it's quite different from working with a typewriter. I mean, I know the touch system. Because you're on the typewriter, my hands anyway, are always like this.
Right.
So that I could pounce on the key. And I see my children work with a word processor. They have their heels of their hands on the table, and their fingers are flying across the keyboard, hardly touching these keys. It's beautiful to watch. They never look at, they never bother looking to see what they've written is correct. They assume it's correct.
Can you take us through a day of composition? What time do you get up?
I always try to be at my desk at 9. I never am. So it's more like 10. And I have to finish the quota, or I can't do anything else.
And what's your quota?
10 triple-spaced pages of typed material. It comes out to about 1,200 words. And I found out that totally by coincidence that was Dickens' daily outcome.
Really? I was going to say that's 12 times Nabokov's. Wasn't Nabokov was happy with 100 words a day, as I recall. But you work with a fountain pen. How?
No. I use a Twist-Ease mechanical pencil.
All right.
I'm glad to give a blurb Twist-Ease. They've really made my life easier.
You mentioned your quota is 10 triple-spaced pages a day, right. 1,200 words. But you've gone to writing, since you can't find the spare parts for the typewriters, you've gone to writing longhand. So have you got someone in the house who does the typing as you write?
No, actually, I have to, it's very expensive. I have to bring in somebody to do the typing.
I see. And
I see how fast they do it. I say, why am I not doing this? But, as I say, I was born too early.
So how long would that typically take to finish the day's quota, or does it vary wildly?
Well, it just varies wildly. If I finish early, I just take the rest of the day off. I don't.
So you really do treat yourself. You reward yourself.
And if it takes into the night, I will work into the night. Of course, this supposes that I've got all the material ready, because in writing a novel, I do just as much reporting.
Well, let's take Back to Blood. How many trips to Miami?
At least a dozen, maybe more. The longest were for a month. I stayed at a different hotel practically every single trip. I recommend the Biltmore and Carl Gables.
All right.
I keep giving these brand blurbs. I had as a great plus was the fact that John Timoney, the chief of police in Miami, is a good friend of mine. I met him here in New York when he was an inspector, which is a fairly high police office. But then he went to Philadelphia, where he was a real star. And he was extremely helpful. He put me on what they call a safe boat. That's what they send out when there's trouble on the seas. The safe boat will go 45 miles an hour on the water, but its main attribute is it's unsinkable. They try to turn them over and sink them. You can't do it. Anyway, that was the plus. And I just started working the way I usually do. Just meet one person, and if you can get along with that person, get into their milieu. And that's the way I found Hialeah, which is the real Little Havana now. What they call Little Havana is in the middle of Miami. And you go to the Cafe Versailles and have a sweet cup of Cuban coffee, which I like. And you go across the street and you watch the old men playing checkers, and you've been to Little Havana. The real Little Havana, but it's not very small, is Hialeah, which to this day I think of as a racetrack. It's not a racetrack anymore. And there's probably 200,000 Cubans living in Hialeah, and Miami itself is only 400,000.
Tom, a slightly impudent question, but don't you suffer from a particular form of the Heisenberg principle that to observe something is to change it, and to observe something in a white suit is presumably to... So how do you stroll into Hialeah and capture it?
Well, I don't go in a white suit, but I do find that I do wear a necktie, and that's enough to set off alarms right away. What the hell is this guy? Is he repossessing somebody? I went to a strip club, which there's 142 strip clubs in the Miami, greater Miami, and with a dark jacket and that, but I also had a necktie. And then I noticed that there was not a single other male in the whole place with a necktie, not even the people at the box office. And next thing I knew, I'm sitting there beginning to watch this show, and a man comes up to me and said, you're Tom Wolfe, aren't you? And I said, well, yes, I am. Wait till people hear about this. I was a little worried, but because, you can't get out of watching pornography by saying, oh, I'm doing research. Nobody will believe that. Then it dawned on me, and nothing ever happened, was because if anybody in a strip club starts giving the names of people who are at a strip club, they're in deep trouble.
So do you fill notebooks? You're at the strip club, you return to the Biltmore or whatever hotel you're staying in, and do you then sit down and begin just a kind of stream of consciousness, note-taking, sights, sounds? How does this...
Well, I try to do... it was a little awkward to take notes in the strip club. If I remember the name, I'll tell you. And
you call it the honeypot in the book.
Yeah. Right. I just can't remember the actual name, but I could take it to it if you'd like to go. So I would go... Before I go to sleep, I try to just record everything I can, because memory decay is very rapid, And these little details that are good for writing are the first things to go. So that's the way I've always worked. And it ends up being just like the long pieces of journalism I've done.
This passage, this is just Tom Wolfe exposition, setting up a scene. This isn't a particularly important passage in the book. It's description. Noon. Noon on yet another identical Miami day. The sky a pale blue, white-hot dome, radiating ferocious heat and blinding light down upon all the shoppers on Collins Avenue and giving them stumpy shadows on the sidewalk. Now that's very good. Stumpy shadows on the sidewalk, you can see that. But here comes the additional detail that makes it Tom Wolfe. Blinding light, which they can scarcely even notice. Their macular degeneration-defying glasses are so dark. And now we have old people who've fled to Florida for the sunshine and are now living in fear of it. And that, I suppose that's the sort of thing that can only come from detail, from reporting.
I think it is. And also, I think you have to have, I think of it as turning the switch on. I mean, I can go through life noticing practically nothing. But if I have the switch on, I will tend to notice these little things, which may or may not be effective, but at least I'll notice them.
Back to Blood and America. You note in the book that more than half the population of Miami was born outside the United States. And yet, in the book, you've got signs of economic buoyancy everywhere. This is a rich place by the standards of human history and most of the world at the present. Miami is a rich place. So on the one hand, the reader might conclude, the system seems to work. And then on the other hand, we've got this scene. Sergei Korolev, the bad guy, is driving in Sunny Isles, which I now know, thanks to Back to Blood, is the Russian part of town. And he's describing it to Magdalena. And he says, I'll do my best with your prose here, if you cannot speak Russian, you cannot buy anything in those shops. They are real Russians. They have no desire to be American. It is like being in Calle Ocho in Miami and walking into a shop and you cannot speak Spanish. They have absolutely no interest to be the Americans either. Russians and Central Americans who just don't want to assimilate.
They, for one thing, tend to live apart from one another. As far as I can tell, the Russians, no matter how much money they have, don't mix with anybody. Mm. The same, there's a Cuban society, you know, of wealthy people like the Cruises and so on, who don't seem to line up with the old WASP. Or, you know, we don't use words like white in Miami. It's too sensitive.
Oh, really?
So it's,
oh, the vocabulary is specialized.
It's Anglo. That is an Anglo is a white person of European background. And, I mean, you could be a Nigerian who was raised, born and raised in London and went to Cambridge, but you do not qualify as an Anglo if you come to South Florida. And it's all based on, and this word Latino, mm-hmm. It started there. It was never used anywhere in the world. Until they had to define these two people, the American whites and the Latin whites. That's one of the most sensitive subjects to this day, is skin color.
But it doesn't worry you. You don't look around Miami and say, there goes the country.
Oh, no. I mean, I'd say, look at that one. That's what I'm constantly, constantly saying.
All right. Again, Back to Blood in America. Freedom, liberty, the Central American value. And here's a scene from Back to Blood in which Magdalena breaks up with a sex addiction expert. Quoting Magdalena, I can't believe I let you do that, Magdalena says to him. And I spend 2 days trying to persuade myself that this is sexual freedom. Freedom, oh my God. Si ahorgame en un pozo de, nasty word, es la libertad. If I want to drown myself in a well of excrement, it's liberty. So to what extent is Tom Wolfe in Back to Blood a Jeremiah warning readers against permitting liberty to become mere license? And to what extent is Tom Wolfe an extremely stylish scribe just reporting what he sees?
I have not brought that level of profundity to the... the act of writing. It's not meant as any kind of warning, but it does describe. It describes decadence. There's a lot of that around, and when the relationship between in this case, a nurse and her employer reaches that level, in which at the end of that scene, he tries to grab hold of her. We don't know what he's going to do. She managed to flee out of the door into a parking lot. He's going to do something that would have never been done in the past. And it's we're at the little edge of the total eclipse of all values.
Right.
It's beginning to happen, and it happens first with kind of formal moral niceties such as boys and girls not living together before marriage and so on.
A couple of final questions. You got your start in newspapers, going if not gone. You worked out your style in magazines, once again, a dying industry, or at least a very dramatically shrinking industry. What do you say to the young man or woman listening to this program who wants to swing for the fences, just the way Tom Wolfe swings for the fences, and write essays and fiction just as big and exuberant as this country?
It's a tough order, as you mentioned. If you read anything on Nook, which is the
e-reader,
if you read things on Nook, at the bottom of the page it'll say this is page 17 of 705 pages. Then that's not a good sign to have it. It seems to be an era in which shorter forms are going to dominate, but you know, Rolling Stone always would run against the odds and succeed. If they had somebody like Hunter Thompson writing a piece like his gonzo journalism.
Or your serialization of Bonfire.
Well, thanks for including me. It could go on forever, and people are going to keep reading forever because of Hunter Thompson's, tremendous. It was skill. It seemed like drunken madness, but it was skill. And maybe that will hold true, but it's difficult to read things on a screen with backlit lighting. And Kindle has done a pretty good job of toning all that down. Nook's hanging in there. I don't know what the result is going to be, whether there's going to be people so used to getting news, for example, online immediately, summaries. You can get news summaries.
Your daughter's a journalist, isn't she?
Yes.
So you've never said to her, you've never called her over and said, look, I'd really advise a career change right now, right now. Nothing like that.
No, because in time, talent will out. This is in the case of Hunter Thompson. It may be more difficult to get what you're writing in front of people with your name on. But I know myself, if I'm reading a piece, whether it's on a computer or on paper, and I'm down about 12 paragraphs, and suddenly I'm struck by some figure of speech or some twist in description, I'll go right back to the top and see, well,
who wrote that?
Usually I start these things, I never notice who wrote them. So talent will prevail, but I think we may have to start publishing books in volumes the way the Japanese do. You know, if a book is going to go run to 500 pages, the hell with it. We'll have 250-page books.
Last question, Tom. When we talked on this program a few years ago, I asked you if you thought the 21st century would be another American century. You remember Henry Luce's famous essay after the Second World War saying the 20th century was the American century. So I said to Tom Wolfe, would the 21st century be an American century? And Tom Wolfe replied, the next six centuries will be American centuries. Do you still feel that way?
I do, because we don't really have any opposition. I mean, everybody's worried about the Arabs at this moment,
right.
The Middle Easterners. Well, the literacy rate is about 8% in those countries, and you cannot run a modern army with people who can't read. You just can't do it. There's too much is dependent on instructions that are, in one way or another, in print, whether it's online or what else. You know, in a way, the whole so-called, well, Arab uprising, Islamic uprising,
right.
Is a cry of anguish because they made a wrong turn at the Enlightenment. They didn't go in for all of these things. It was not by chance that the British were the first avant-garde in the sciences, mm-hmm. medicine, everything. It's because they had kicked out the Church of Rome, thanks to Henry VIII's love life, and established the idea that it's okay to rebel. I mean, here isn't what he said, but it became all right to rebel, to protest, to be a Protestant, let's say. And that led to this great opening up of what we now call the Enlightenment. And I really think that in these Islamist countries, they're angry that things didn't go there. I don't think it's a religious thing.
So they still have values, and yeah. We're experiencing the eclipse of all values, but we'll still win.
They definitely have values, no question.
Tom Wolfe, author of Back to Blood. Thank you.
Peter, thank you.
My pleasure, my pleasure. For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson. Thanks for joining us.